We are lucky enough to live, work, and record this podcast on the land of the Kaurna people. We acknowledge their ongoing connection to sea country and the importance of Indigenous knowledge in caring for the ocean. Welcome to our second episode of The Ocean Pod, a new podcast about all things to do with marine science and the ocean. You are once again joined by myself, Dr. Nina Wooten, and my co-host, Professor Bronwyn Galanders. We are both marine ecologists from the University of Adelaide, with a huge passion for all things to do with the ocean. Today, we're going to be bringing a new segment that we're doing. It's going to be called Tide Talk. And what we're planning to do is at the end, at the beginning of each episode, we're going to have a chat about something cool that we have seen during the week that has just been to do with the ocean. So this could be a cool fact or a paper that we have come across, an experience that we have had, a new story that we wanted to chat about. It's literally open to however we want to do it. We're calling it Tide Talk. And Bronwyn, I might start off with you. What did you want to bring to our listeners' attention this week to do with Tide Talk? What's been making waves for you this week?
Well, actually, I was reading The Economist this morning and there was a bit there around plastics and recycling. And I think what was quite interesting around reading about that is the amount of plastics that can be recycled. So one of the issues is you get plastics that are made up of multiple types of plastics, and that creates challenges for recycling because obviously you can't just cut them up and recycle them. But what they were saying is there's companies that are coming up with ways to recycle some of those. But what that can mean is that in the new products, you've only got a small percentage of recycled plastic, say 10%, and a large amount of virgin plastics. So does that count as recycled plastic or is it new plastic? And so that's some of the challenges that like the European Union and Britain and various places are facing right now. So I thought that was really quite interesting.
That is cool. Recycling is so complex. Mm-hmm. I've been doing a lot of reading on recycling lately because of this work we're doing with some of the fishing communities to do with recycling plastic from fisheries and aquaculture, and the mixed polymer types, when there's different types of plastic in one product, is really complex.
But that's what they were saying, and they were saying that often it's just dumped into landfill or incinerated, those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But Nina, let's move to you. What's your Tide Talk for this episode?
For this week, I'm also bringing to an article to our attention that came out recently from CSIRO. The lead author was Stephanie Brody, and it had Denise Hardesty also on there and Catherine Willis as co-authors. We work with some of these people regularly, so it's really fun to read articles from people that you know. But this paper came out in Marine Pollution Bulletin, and it was saying actually that we, over the last 10 years, have seen a decrease in plastic marine debris around metropolitan areas. So I find this, well, it's really positive. I think it means that we're doing some good things to reduce plastic.
And did they have some potential reasons as to why we might be seeing that decrease?
Well, I think some of it is to do with awareness and beach cleans. Mm. There's obviously been a lot more plastic bans come in place since in that 10-year period. Like, think about what was being used in the plastic space even 10 years ago. Now there's a lot of these single-use items that are banned.
So things like the supermarket shopping bags that you can't even get the single-use ones anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of positive things. I do wonder if, I guess, there's still a lot of plastic that's probably still going out into the marine environment that might be getting cleaned up before it gets there, which is a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're using less, perhaps. It's just getting cleaned up.
Yeah, because if you look at the Torrens River here in South Australia, they have big trash traps.
Yeah, the trash traps.
Yeah, yeah, on some of the inflows coming into that river that would take out the gross pollutants at least.
Yeah, they've got these things set up now to help reduce that, but it also means, I guess, we're still producing as much.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not ideal. But anyway, I thought that was an interesting paper, a bit of positive news in the plastic space, because sometimes it does get a bit down in the dumps in that's my main area of research. So literally down in the dumps. I didn't even mean to make that joke, but but it is a nice to have some positive news. And I think science, sometimes we need to make sure we bring the positive stuff to light as well.
That's exactly right, particularly in the area of environmental issues where people do tend to focus on some of the negatives. So it's really lovely to see a positive outcome there.
Yeah, for sure. Today's episode is all about one of our favourite marine species, the giant Australian cuttlefish. And we are lucky enough that Bronwyn is actually a world-recognised expert in these beautiful species. So today I think I'll be interviewing her to find out about all things to do with cuttlefish. I guess let's talk a little bit about incredible giant Australian cuttlefish. They are masters of disguise. And they're famous for their mind-blowing colour changes. But especially here in South Australia, the Spencer Gulf is home to one of the most spectacular breeding events where all of these animals move up at certain times of year. And I think that time of year might be coming soon, which Bronwyn will touch on shortly. And they breed up there. So let's dive into learning more about the giant Australian cuttlefish. So Bronwyn, let's start off with, can you tell me exactly what a giant Australian cuttlefish is?
Yeah, so they're regarded as cephalopods, so that's a group of mollusks, and the broader group of mollusks that cephalopods are part of contain things like your octopus, your squid, of course the cuttlefish, but also the nautilus. And that name cephalopod's actually a Greek word which means head foot. So if you have a look at them, they've got a prominent head, set of arms or tentacles, and their arms and tentacles is actually modified from what would normally be a foot in your snails and things. So that's cephalopods generally, but giant Australian cuttlefish, they're some of the larger cuttlefish. They're not as big as your giant squid, obviously, but they can reach up to 10 kilos and a metre or more in length. So they grow, they get to that size basically in a year to 18 months. So they grow incredibly fast.
Wow, that's crazy. A metre in length. That's actually not that much shorter than me, if you think about it. I think I'm 160 centimetres or so. So that actually is big.
The ones on the east coast of Australia get much bigger than the ones that we see in Spence Gulf, probably because they're a different population. We have had one from across the east coast that was about 13 kilos, so that's massive.
Is that the biggest one you've ever seen?
I think so. And I actually do find them a little bit scary when they're coming towards you underwater.
Yeah, they're a bit creepy, aren't they?
When they're so large and that you can just see these tentacles coming kind of towards you, and they've obviously got that beak as well, and they will bite, but like a parrot's beak.
I guess maybe we could go into now, let's talk a little bit about why giant Australian cuttlefish are so important for Australian marine ecosystems. Can you touch a bit on that?
Yep. So they're voracious predators, so they eat a whole variety of marine life, things like fish, your crustaceans, which are your crabs, but also other cephalopods. They're also a really important food source for a whole range of large marine predators, so things like other species of fish, your dolphins, your seabirds. You often see dolphins feeding on them. So cuttlefish are the sort of species that breed once and then die, like some salmon do. And you often see dolphins feeding on them as they're on the surface there in their dead and dying stage.
Oh, so they only have one life cycle. So they'll breed and then...
And then die, yes.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's why they're short-lived. So they basically aggregate up at Point Lowly, which is just out from Whyalla, solely for the purpose of breeding.
Wow, that's crazy. I guess I have heard that these like giant Australian cuttlefish Do other cephalopods aggregate like that to breed?
Some of your squid might. There might be a few that do, but not all of them. So even the giant Australian cuttlefish aggregates to breed just that population that's in Upper Spencer Gulf. Elsewhere across southern Australia, they don't aggregate in the same numbers.
Okay.
So up at Point Lowly, there can be one cuttlefish per square metre, if you like. Elsewhere across the range, you tend to have one per 100 square metres.
Okay, so that's kind of the general way that they're distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what draws them to these hotspots? So we'll talk a bit later on in the podcast, I'm sure, about how you can go and see the giant Australian cuttlefish in the next few months up at Point Lowly, which is near Whyalla. But they are known to aggregate there. Do you know why? Is it a habitat thing? Or?
So we're not 100% sure, but that area where they aggregate to breed, which is really spatially limited, so it's about a 6 kilometre stretch of coastline. It's one of the only areas of rocky reef where you've got that undercut rock that's suitable for them to lay their eggs on. So they basically lay the eggs on the underside of the rocks there. So that's possibly one of the reasons that they aggregate there, something that's perhaps evolved through time.
Okay, so it's to do with the habitat, I guess, and the structure. I'm sure there's other areas that are that sort of habitat.
Yeah, so not so much in that Upper Spencer Gulf region. And if you start looking elsewhere across the range of them, there's a lot more rocky reef habitat. So if you look along that Point Lowly stretch, it's like within 50 to 100 metres of shore is where that rocky reef bit is, and then it drops out to seagrass, and they don't lay their eggs on the seagrass.
Yeah, it's a very specific sort of habitat they need, I guess, which is probably why they might be a bit more impacted potentially by changes in habitat and also climate changes. Can you talk a little bit to that? Are there any kind of, you know, climate change or other environmental factors that might be affecting the behaviour of cuttlefish populations?
Yeah, so all of the cephalopods are quite, so they respond quite rapidly to changes in environmental conditions. So they, like, if you get improvement in temperature, they can grow quite rapidly. But for the giant Australian cuttlefish, we do know that if that Gulf region gets much more saline, for example, then that's got potential to impact on the species. So what we know about them is that when we've done experiments with them in different salinities, the salinity that they're at now is the best salinity. So it's a bit higher than marine waters because Upper Spencer Gulf is what's referred to as an inverse estuary. So the salinity is higher at the head of it and it goes down to marine waters, whereas most estuaries have got fresh water coming in, so they're lower salinity and then it gets to higher salinity. So the salinity around Point Lowly is around 40 parts per thousand, and that's optimal for giant Australian cuttlefish eggs to develop. As soon as we get to 45 or 50, 45 they're still surviving, 50 they pretty much won't survive in that salinity. So there's potential for high salinity to impact them, but also potentially temperature. And we're not sure whether some of the things around temperature might actually be what's influencing the abundance from one year to the next.
Okay, that's really interesting. Do you think that if, as climate change happens and our ocean levels drop a little bit or rise a little bit, I guess just fluctuating depending on what's happening in the environment, that will change the salinity then?
Yeah, you mean rise in temperature and in salinity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so potentially it could influence them. The question, I guess, that most people, or that's really challenging to address, is these things don't happen in a hurry, so they happen gradually, and it's where the species can adapt to those changes.
Yeah, I know there's lots of fluctuations in the population numbers that occur up at Point Lowly. Like some years we have really good numbers and other years they drop off, but then they seem to recover. Are there people who are taking abundance data surveys regularly?
Yeah, so the SARDI Aquatic Sciences has been monitoring their abundance, and it initially started with Karina Hall, who was a PhD student at University of Adelaide and also at SARDI Aquatic Sciences, and she was recording the abundances back in the late 90s. And then from there it's been undertaken by various people, but using the same methodology. So they do fluctuate greatly from one year to the next. And what we actually know from some of the work that Nick Payne did tested where he tagged individuals and he was able to follow how long they were on the breeding aggregation, is that the females are there for much shorter time than the males, and none of them are there for the full 4 months of the breeding season. So potentially we've got an increase in abundance compared to what the estimates of abundance are.
Okay, wow. This is a bit maybe off topic, but do you know how many eggs they lay?
I'm not entirely sure how many eggs they lay, but it's quite a few.
Yeah, so like high-ish
like
numbers.
It's tens not... to, yeah, probably in the tens, like probably not more than 100, I don't think.
Okay, in that kind of space. Interesting.
Yeah, so the eggs like start off when they're first laid is they're stuck to the rock and they're very whitish. And as they develop, you can actually see little miniature cephalopods inside them, little miniature cuttlefish.
I've seen those photos. Yeah, they're so cute.
Yeah, they are very cute. They're about the size, when they hatch out, they're about the size of a thumbnail, if you like. But they don't have a larval stage, so they essentially go to the bottom of the ocean, a benthic, from the moment that they hatch. And then they disappear off that breeding aggregation and are out in Upper Spencer Gulf. And then we don't really know a lot about them from the time they hatch to when they come back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if they're swimming away or getting taken by currents, or maybe a mixture of both?
I'd say a mixture of both.
Yeah.
The one thing we do know is in that Upper Spencer Gulf region, if you look at the sex of them, there's equal numbers of males and females. But when you look on the breeding aggregation, there's more males compared to females. So that has really interesting dynamics around reproduction and mate choice and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, for sure. I want to talk a bit about behaviour, actually. That flows on quite nicely. I've seen it because I've been snorkeling and diving up with the cuttlefish a few times. It is a very magical experience. I've seen the different mating behaviours that are exhibited by males. Can you talk a little bit more about some of these different behaviours that they show to try to snag the female?
Yeah, sure. So the males are trying to make sure that they look big and like, you see the chromatophores contracting and expand.
Wait, what's a chromatophore?
It's like a cell in the body that controls the colour of them.
Oh, the colour. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and you can see these ripples going across the body of the big cuttlefish, and the males, like one male's trying to show the other that he's much bigger, and at the same time you can get little males that are trying to sneak a mating while this big male's focused on another big male. And so that can happen, like you can see that actually happening, but you also get some of those little males that impersonate females. So they're trying to pretend that they look a bit more like a female such that they can sneak a mating.
Oh, it's so sneaky.
Yeah. But it's fascinating to watch, really fascinating. They mate in a head-to-head position, and so you can see them connected, if you like, and then the male transfers a spermatophore, which is a packet of sperm, into the female, and then the female is able to lay the eggs.
Wow. So one female can only get impregnated from one packet of sperm, or...?
So there's potential for the sperm to be in the female, like from multiple males.
Okay. And then, wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, they really are quite amazing to watch.
Yeah, the way
they do it. Yeah, and then obviously they lay the eggs and they're quite in under the rocks. So you can usually look, if you're diving, or snorkeling, I guess, you can usually look under the rocks and see the eggs. But if you stick your arm way in, and maybe you shouldn't try this because you never know what else is in there.
We would recommend not doing that.
but you can feel the eggs way back in under the underhanging rock.
Oh, cool. So have you done any research where you test eggs or...?
Yeah. So we did do some experiments where we were looking at how eggs responded to different temperatures and salinities. And we've also done some work looking at whether there's ways of marking eggs such that when the little cuttlefish hatch out, they've got a signature in them. But it's a bit like when they come back again, it's a bit like we were trying to track whether they came back to the same area that they were laid from. It's a bit like searching for a needle in a haystack some ways.
They're so little, for sure. So I guess I want to talk a bit more about how cuttlefish have captured the public's imagination. I know that there's sort of, at this time of year, as we're going into the cuttlefish breeding season, we have Cuttlefest, which is, a group of locals and people from all around Australia. People travel to see these cuttlefish from other international countries. Like, I've seen people there who have come far and wide to see this wonderful breeding aggregation, but they sort of have captured the public's imagination. Do you think you can give us some ideas on why you think they resonate with people so much?
They're a bit like aliens in the sea, aren't they? Yeah, and you're exactly right. People do come from around the world. Film crews come from around the world. Scientists come from around the world. If you're studying camouflage, for instance, which cuttlefish are really great at doing, where else do you get so many specimens in such a small area? And so you can get so much data in such a short period of time. But just talking about resonating with the public, do you remember the Golden Globes Awards where Jodie King wore a dress that resembled a cuttlefish?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember it, but I've seen the photo before. You've talked about that. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
I think that's very cool. Yeah very cool.
They have quite a magical wave to them almost.
Like they do.
It's very mesmerising to watch, I think. People find it's pleasing on the eye.
I think that's probably why people like them, is that they're very relatable, and these kind of the way that they come at you with their little tentacles and their head sort of region.
Yeah, definitely. And I've also seen there's a lot of cuttlefish included in different artistic things. I think people love to draw them because they're probably, I mean, the camouflage aspect of them, they're very beautiful to draw, and they've just got this magical metallic almost mesmerizing. They're a bit more like a mermaid or something.
Yeah.
It's very cool. I think, do you have anything else you want to talk about in terms of your research? Like, what is probably your most, I mean, it's hard to say you do so much great research, but what would be one of your most exciting discoveries you've made about giant Australian cuttlefish?
I think some of the work we've done around the population structure of them, so how the species is structured across its entire range, and discovering that upper Spencer Gulf region, from about Wallaroo across to Arno Bay, that's pretty much the extent of the population that aggregates up at Point Lowley. So the rest of them that are in southern Spencer Gulf and Gulf of St Vincent don't go up to aggregate on the breeding aggregation.
Oh, they don't go up there.
Yeah,
so
no.
So where are they going?
They're just going to a local reef nearby. There's probably, like, if you think about it, there's reef all over the place.
Yeah.
And so just anywhere else. But
we probably should have mentioned, actually, for those people that might not have had the chance to see cuttlefish before, in their live form, you might have seen them washed up on the beach, those cuttle bones.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't realise, I do a lot of school outreach and education work, and we often talk about cuttlefish and people can't picture it until I say, oh, you know, the cuttle bones. And they say, the kids often say to me, oh, I feed that to my budgie.
That's right. And you can even buy them in the supermarket, which I find astounding.
Yeah.
But yeah, that white cuttle bone. So that white cuttle bone is only found in cuttlefish, whereas if you start looking at your other cephalopods, like your squid, they've got a residual kind of, or they've got this pen, it's called a pen, but it looks like thickened sellotape that runs along the length of
them. Yeah, I've seen that before, yeah.
And then your octopus have a residual shell in the head of them. And then the only group that still has an external shell are the nautilus.
Okay. Oh,
which is really
so it's
cool.
Interesting that the nautilus are included in that in that cephalopod group, actually.
Yeah.
That is very cool. I guess let's go on now. I want to talk a bit about the conservation of giant Australian cuttlefish, and I guess how can people become more engaged in the conservation side of things? We'll end on talking about how you can get involved in actually snorkeling and seeing the cuttlefish. But in terms of if you can't get into the water, what's a cool way that you could become engaged from a conservation perspective?
So I guess just knowing about the legislation around some of the fisheries and those sorts of things. So if you're a fisher, for example, being aware that you're not allowed to take cuttlefish from that upper Spencer Gulf region, and then being aware of the marine parks. So there is a cuttlefish coast sanctuary area. That's right there on the near the breeding aggregation, and that helps protect the cuttlefish itself. But you can still line fish for fish species, but not obviously for cephalopods.
Okay, so cuttlefish, you can catch cuttlefish to eat, not in the breeding aggregation area.
That's right. So if you're wanting to go fishing off Adelaide, for instance, you can still catch them. But why would you eat them?
Yeah, I don't reckon they taste very good. I'm a big seafood lover, but I don't think that cuttlefish would be as yummy as squid.
We actually had squid for dinner the other night, was just amazing.
Another type of cephalopod.
That's right, but I wouldn't eat cuttlefish.
No, I think you have too much of a personal connection.
That's right.
It would be hard to eat them. Hey, I want to talk about now how people can get involved in terms of if you want to go see the giant Australian cuttlefish, which are breeding. When do their breeding season start?
So it's quite temporally restricted. The worst thing is it's during winter. So they start coming in late April, early May usually, and then you can usually see them. Peak abundance is usually in middle of June, early July, that sort of time period, and they've usually gone by August.
Okay.
So the key thing to be aware of is winter. So the water temperature is quite cold and you probably need a wetsuit.
We are in South Australia, so I think the water, when I went, I think it was 12 degrees or something.
Yes.
Serious brain freeze.
Yes.
But worth it.
Yeah, the other way that you can do it, though, is there's now a glass bottom boat that takes people out. And last year I actually went out on the glass bottom boat and you can see quite a lot happening underwater because it's relatively shallow. So where they're aggregating to breed is like 2, 3, 4 metres water depth. So you're talking relatively shallow. And so from that surface you can actually see quite a lot.
For sure.
But also when my son was quite young, this family had bought this inflatable boat, and what they'd done is out of the bottom of rubbish bins, they had cut out the base and put in Perspex so the kids could be in their thin wetsuits. It's really hard to get thick wetsuits for children. And they were in the boat with their life jackets and their wetsuits on, and then they were using these cut out rubbish bins as viewing platforms to look over the edge of the boat.
Oh, so it's kind of like your own glass bottom boat.
It was. It was amazing. Amazing.
That is cool. So in terms of if you... So the cuttlefish are located in Point Loli, which we've already said, which is probably a 20-minute drive out of Whyalla.
Mm-hmm.
And Whyalla is about a 4-hour drive from Adelaide. So you drive up to the top of the Spencer Gulf and then around the top. So you get to Port Augusta and then it's about 1 hour to get to Whyalla. If you're not from Adelaide, obviously you would have to fly into Adelaide. I would say you probably need a car. It's not really that accessible by a bus. You might be able to, there might be some tours organised, but I think having your own car is probably
having
the best
your own vehicle. The other thing you can do is fly from Adelaide to Whyalla. There are flights that go from Adelaide to Whyalla, but to get out to Point Loli, you'd really need a vehicle. But the other, you can also snorkel on them. So Experiencing Marine Sanctuaries, which I actually chair, they run snorkel trips out there during the peak breeding season most years.
Yeah.
And then there's also a dive shop in Whyalla that has wetsuits, etc., that you can hire. But through Experiencing Marine Sanctuaries, they come with own wetsuit,
snorkel, you get everything.
Yeah, you do.
Fins, you get all what you need.
Yeah.
And a hood, I definitely recommend a hood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because your brain will get cold.
Yeah, so it's a really great opportunity to go up there and see them, and there's lots of scope to snorkel on them. If you're an experienced snorkeler or diver, you can just go off the shore yourself,
which is amazing. It's really easy, and they've actually just renovated that area. I think there's nice new change rooms and toilets there as well, so it's much better than it used to be. I remember when I went maybe 5 years ago, I had to get changed in the freezing cold next to your car, and it's just now it's much easier and better facilities, I would say.
And also much better parking for people.
They've
as well.
They've updated it a lot. I think it's looking really good there. It's exciting. I think I'll have to go this year.
Yeah.
We've inspired myself to go again. You can definitely scuba dive as well. So I've scuba dived twice and snorkeled there twice on 4 different years. And obviously, as we were talking about before, different years have different fluctuations, and also depending on the time of year when you go, you might see them in full mating season, or you might be at the end of the season where they're sort of dying off. But scuba diving, would you scuba dive or snorkel if you had the option to either?
I like both, but snorkeling's like you're weightless virtually, like whereas scuba diving, you've got to lug this heavy tank across the, like there is a platform that you can go down, but you've got to get in off the rocks. Once you're in the water, it's fine. You probably, if you're on scuba, you can be more at the level with them.
Probably whereas, better for photography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're snorkeling, you've got to duck dive a bit more.
Yeah. But I mean, both are awesome. So I don't think it's one of those amazing sites where you definitely don't have to scuba to see pretty much everything.
Absolutely. And then if the water temperature puts you off completely, or you just feel that you're not quite up to getting in the water, then the glass bottom boat's amazing as well.
Exactly. Definitely get a wetsuit though. I had one friend once who said, "Do I need a wetsuit?" You need a wetsuit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're snorkeling or diving. If you're in the glass bottom boat, then...
just rug up.
Yeah, rug up, because it can get cold up there with the wind off the ocean and things.
Yeah, for sure. But definitely a recommend. I'm going to encourage lots of my friends and family to go out this year. And we're patiently waiting for the first arrival. They should be coming in the next week or two, I hope. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I think that might be the end of this episode. Do you have anything else you want to leave on parting notes? It's been amazing to talk to you, Bronwyn. I mean, I get to spend so much time with Bronwyn anyway, but to actually dive deeply into talking about the wonderful giant Australian cuttlefish from one of our global experts on the species. Anything you want to finish on?
I still get excited every time I see them. It's just amazing snorkeling and diving on them.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, that's awesome. I guess this brings me to the end of this week's episode. If you've got any questions or cool ocean facts or stories to share, make sure you hit us up on social media or through email. All of our contact details can be found in the show notes. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Anyone that wants to reach out and tell us that you're enjoying the podcast, or if you think it's terrible, you can tell us that in a kind way maybe, but we love all feedback. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure you follow along on the Ocean Pod wherever you're listening, so through Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and leave us a review. It'll help us find more ocean lovers. And that's us for now. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Bye.
Music written and performed by Seamus Nicholas. Graphic design by Rhiannon Van Eck. This podcast is produced by us, Nina and Bronwyn, supported by the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide.